Latino, Puerto Rican poos with the tan right. This was Tin Can Phone Contraband. We'll be at you next week. So peace, love, free all the dogs, the real ones.
Facts. Hey, Joe, you said Mike can't come back with the unless the contraband is stuffed in his pants, right? Are we holding you to
that's
that?
Right.
We holding
no,
you
that's, we're holding him to that.
All right.
I hope he can hear us, Mike. You
take
better
us
have something.
Out. Hey, this is becoming Contraband. Get out of here.
Contraband.
Right. Deuces, everybody.
Coming soon. I am Contraband.
Hey.
The Contraband slashed out.
We're stopping this.
You were listening to the Tin Can Phone Podcast, where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the sources. We tell the stories from the inside out. So make sure to check us out on Cable Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m. You can also check us out on Spotify, Apple, and anywhere you love to catch your podcast. And make sure to give us a follow over at tincanphonepodcast.com. And follow our Instagram at tincanphonepodcast. This Misfit Audio.
Hi, I'm David Brower, David R. Brower. And I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States. And that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland. And I wish you had a lot more company.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
The George Floyd protests went on in cities around the world and has begun important conversations regarding police training and accountability. The protests in Portland, Oregon went on for over 100 nights and made international news. My guest, John Meyer, is a filmmaker in Portland and has produced a documentary entitled Tipping Point. On this episode of Times Like Now. Hello, John Meyer. Thank you for joining me today. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm in my office in Southeast Portland, and I'm just here by myself. It's normally a little bit more bustling, but I'm just here by myself, so it worked out perfect for this.
That's great. Thank you for joining me. And your film, Tipping Point, I had the luxury or the special access to watch the film. I understand it's not out there yet as you're trying to find distribution, which is great. I hope you do succeed in that. I hope this film gets out. Is the trailer out there for people to watch?
The trailer is out. It's on YouTube. It's hard to find on there because it doesn't have very many views, but it has tons of views on Facebook. It has like 20,000 views. So, you know, when there's more views, they turn up in search results easier. So if you go to the Old Church's Facebook page, that's where it's at. So TOC sometimes is referred to it as, but the Old Church Concert Hall, which is nothing to do with an actual church. It's just
right. And maybe if they were to search JONMEYER.
Yeah, I mean, you'll find my stuff. I don't think that would be harder to find the trailer doing that.
Okay, so we recommend the Old Church.
For sure. That's where, and then if you really want to get right to it, just go to the video tab and it's like the third one. Yeah.
Okay. This documentary focused on the George Floyd Black Lives Matter protests in Portland, Oregon. This went on for over 100 nights in downtown Portland. It made international news. Everybody probably knows of this. And you were out there toe to toe in the thick of it, and you took quite a bit of risk to life and limb, and I understand you took some stitches from this. What happened?
I'm glad you asked. It's quite an interesting story about how I got stabbed. I was stabbed by a Proud Boy, or somebody who identifies as a Proud Boy, and so basically the entire time I was down there, I felt kind of a sense of security. I hate to say it, but it's because I'm white. Anytime I got near the cops, then it was just like there was this kind of, I could look him right in the eye and I can kind of just gauge it. And they were just, they kind of gave me the look. They saw my camera. They saw I wasn't yelling or waving flaming things. And I could just kind of tell that, like, you know, they were definitely going to gas me along with everyone else. And I got gassed and it was horrible. But I did have a kind of a sense of security that they weren't going to single me out and hurt me. Eventually they did, and that changed my perspective, but that was near the end. But the two times that I got where I really feared for my safety wasn't actually from the cops. It was from the Proud Boys both times. And the other time was more scary than the stabbing, even though I had to get stitches and everything for that. It was a vehicle, a Dodge Charger, blasted through some protesters standing in the streets with what it appeared to be the intent of hitting and killing as many people as possible. He was going by 80 miles an hour right through, and everybody leapt out of the way and just barely missed it. It's in the documentary. You can see I filmed it, and it's really scary, but it didn't make news because he didn't hit anybody. And so it just, that's what happens. It's like, if no one gets killed or maimed, then it just doesn't make the news, you know, even if the intent was there.
Yeah.
And so that happened a week after the stabbing. And so that's when I called it quits, actually. I was like, I can't, there's too much risk, and the cops don't seem to be doing anything to tame the Proud Boys. If anything, they work with them. And I have lots of evidence to corroborate that claim.
So. Yes, as of today, Canada has ruled Proud Boys a terrorist organization. That speaks volumes.
Oh, before we continue, I didn't even tell you the most important part of that story. Sorry, I got sidetracked. When I got stabbed, it was I blame the police for that, actually, not the person who stabbed me, because they showed up as a mob. You know, I feel like I got caught in the melee. Like, I wasn't singled out. I think I was just on the wrong side of the line, you know? And to me, it's like, this was broad daylight. It was day about 80 or so of the sustained protests, where every single night we clashed hard with the police, and they made lots of arrests and tear gassed and all sorts of stuff. You can see it all in the doc, and I'm sure you saw it in the news. And that was 100% of the days were like that. There wasn't a single day off where the cops didn't have some sort of violent interaction with the protesters. Then the Proud Boys show up in a group of about 200 to 300 of them, and it was the one time that the cops didn't show up. And they were actually there. They were on the other side of the parking garage, hiding, basically, in a big, large group of them. And they actually came out of hiding and tear gassed everybody after, like, a minute after all the Proud Boys left, after they were there for about 3 hours and brawling and breaking windows and slashing tires. I mean, it was crazy. Breaking arms, breaking hands. People got really injured there. It was obvious they were there for a brawl. They showed up with weapons and loaded guns. They were pointing at people. They had shields with, which indicates, you know, they want to fight, but their shields had screws pointing outward. So they were weapons. They weren't just defensive. Anyway, I blame the cops, because why didn't the cops come in and stop the first actual riot of the entire protest? Because everything else they deemed a riot every day leading up to that wasn't a riot. No one was rioting. They were protesting, and maybe loudly, but they weren't rioting. I mean, it depends on how you define rioting, but to me, it's a brawl and breaking windows and breaking and slashing tires. That's a riot, and that's what was happening. And so they didn't show up, and lo and behold, it blew up, and people got limbs broken, and I got stabbed, and yeah.
Yes, the whole thing is a cluster and went down very, very wrong. Of course, things were at a point where there were a few hundred people, and then till the federal agents came in, and the crowd immediately ballooned to 2,000-plus people.
It was quoted low-end 10,000, high-end 20,000 for the Saturday night that after the feds moved in. That was the biggest night of the whole summer. Yeah, there was many thousands around that whole week, but there was a Saturday night specifically when Ted Wheeler went down there and talked, and that's when the crowds drew as possibly as much as 20,000, low-end 10,000.
Ted Wheeler being the mayor of Portland, Oregon. Of course. You know, this made international news. This was a big deal. It went on. And in your documentary, I note a conflict between the Black Lives Matter protesters, the people who were there to make their point heard about George Floyd. And then there was another faction that seems to be just there to break windows and cause trouble and cause chaos and anarchy. And that always seems to be the incident. Now, Portland has an old history of being against those with Confederate flags or those with Nazi flags. They will always come down to meet those people. Your video does a fine job of showing the contrast between the two groups. One group is very clearly saying we're here to make a point.
I didn't know I did a good enough job on that, so thank you.
I'm sorry, say that again.
I said I didn't know if I did a good enough job on that. That was hard to do, so thank you for noticing.
No, I think it is hard because in your documentary, you just let the people speak. You're not in this at all. And I like those kinds of documentaries that just lets the story unfold and lets the tale be told. And this, I think, did a great job. And that was, in fact, there's a clip that from that really stands out to me. One of the people on the street brings this up to a camera person, and I wanted to play that, if that's all right.
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
You said whenever this ends.
Right.
How do you think this is?
You would have to go ask the people throwing mortars. We're not doing that.
We never know what's gonna go down.
So if you want to know when that's gonna end, you'll have to go ask them.
I will literally go tell them, how is this for our cause? How is this helping our cause? Oh, because Black Lives Matter. But why does Black Lives Matter to you? We don't have the right to be shooting off fireworks at federal buildings. That's not a right that we were given. So that is diminishing our message by doing things like that.
Now it's kind of just turned into this police versus people. I don't even call it Black Lives Matter anymore. It's just the police versus people.
What is the end goal? And are we making any progress? Or is just this night after night after night and we know what's going to happen? It doesn't feel productive or useful for me anymore to be going out every day and just watching the police be brutal.
Some very powerful quotes. Some of the people that you interview in this documentary, the activists, Mike Crenshaw, as well as his name comes to mind,
yeah,
as a Portland entertainer and activist for many, many years. I was very impressed with the behind the scenes. The street stuff is amazing and dramatic and frightening. But the interviews you do later on with folks, the fella, forgive me his name, that was attacked on the MAX train and was stabbed.
Micah Fletcher,
a very eloquent speaker, very well spoken. I was very impressed with a lot of content that these folks have to say. The message is clear. The message is important. And I hope this documentary gets out.
Yeah, Mike Crenshaw, I could have made the whole documentary with just him narrating, and I even considered it because he was so good. His interview was so powerful, and there was so much stuff we couldn't get into just for time sake. So much so that I run a music documentary series called Contrast with a K, and that's what I was doing before and now after the tipping point. And I think I'm going to approach Mike. I haven't talked to him yet, but I'm going to approach Mike and see if he would let me cover him for one of my 10-minute episodes of that, just because I need to get more of his info out. He's just such an awesome resource. He was raised in Minneapolis, and so he knew about and was victims of the racist policing in Minneapolis before he moved to Portland. So he had a lot of really interesting takes.
Now, the folks who were down there organizing with medical, with food, they were just serving food. They were just trying to take care of the rubber bullets. And I use that word because they're not rubber bullets. That makes it sound so peaceful and like airsoft or something. It's not rubber bullets. The one fellow who was hit square in the face, that did make news. He was standing in the crowd and was hit square in the face from a federal, was that a federal agent or was that a Portland police officer?
It was a federal agent. Yeah, he was standing in front of the federal building. He got shot, and it's my belief, and you won't hear this anywhere else just because this is my own theory. It's my belief that the federal agent was trying to make him look stupid by shooting what's it called, the stereo he was holding above his head. And I think he was trying to break that. I'm not trying to excuse the feds' behavior. I just can't fathom someone aiming for someone's skull like that. Like, that just doesn't enter the realm of possibility for me, because I just it's so hard to, because he was not, you know, you see there's video of it, he was clearly not approaching them, or he was a safe distance away, he wasn't on their property, there wasn't even a crowd around, he was kind of the only one. And like, I think the Fed was just trying to get that he missed and can't own up to that, because even that would be admitting that he was shooting, you know, if he was saying I was shooting the stereo out of his hand, then he would have to admit that he went against protocol.
Right, because I believe the protocol on those weapons, they are supposed to be bounced off of the street. Have you heard that? You
know, I don't think that's actually a protocol for rubber bullets. The rubber bullets were, once again, I'm not trying to excuse their behavior, but the truth is they were hardly ever used out there. It was mostly pepper balls, and those you got to bounce off the street, is what my understanding is. And I got hit with pepper balls, and those weren't that bad. The rubber bullets are way worse.
Again, no excuse for such a thing, especially for, you know, and you do speak with some police officers, and I found that to be, you know, kind of enlightening and, you know, helpful to hear how they feel about it. The chief of police at the time, again, he states most of the officers are there to do a good job and to protect the city, but it can't be helped to kind of question that when you see your video and when you hear stories such as you and many, many others are telling. What they say does not really come out as factual when you get right down to it, as you said.
Yeah, and I wonder if you noticed that there was a couple sly edits I did in there, which were not a manipulation of truth. They just were sly edits, but it was totally truthful. But there were times when the officer says, "We always give a warning before tear gassing. It's part of our policy." And then I cut to Sol Luna saying, "Sometimes there's never," or no, he says, like, about half the time, there's just no warning. It's just like, as soon as they're issuing the warning, the tear gas is already out, you know? And that's correct. That's the correct, because I was out there and I got gassed, and there was no warning whenever I actually inhaled the gas. When there was a warning, I'd get out of there because I wasn't wearing a mask. I didn't wear a gas mask because I couldn't shoot by putting my eye up to my camera that way. So I always just tried to stay upwind, which actually really helped. And then sometimes they get me anyway, though. And that's when I got really upset because there was no warning.
Well, there were thousands of cell phones recording all of this from 1,000 angles. Besides you took your video and made something with it. But there are literally thousands of videos, and I'm sure many, many of them are upon YouTube and other places to see this kind of this contradiction as we're discussing the supposed warning. And that's, again, that's just not the truth when you get down onto the street level. It seemed a war zone. It literally felt, from your video, from your movie Tipping Point, the name, like a war zone. And I'm sure it must have felt like that, especially when the feds come in military attire.
I mean, I'm not a veteran or anything, so I cannot speak to what a war zone is actually like. But as far as feeling like a war zone, maybe not a war zone, but feeling like one with the smoke and the bangs that were so loud, you can't hear other people warning you that stuff is coming because there's so many pops and bangs, and you can't see because of the gas is getting in. I mean, I gotta agree with you. It sure felt like what my impression of a war zone is like.
Well, I mean, to be frank and to be blunt, when the police come in with that kind of weaponry, and then the Proud Boys and others come through 200 strong with shields and guns and knives because you were stabbed in this incident, that is a war zone. There are people there to do you harm.
Yeah.
Cars being driven through to run down people. That is a war zone in my mind.
Fair enough. I'm just watching the series Pacific right now. And I just saw the first episode, and there's like a beach with like 100,000 dead bodies on it. And I'm like, yeah, that's a war zone. So, yeah, you're right, though.
Okay. War might be a strong word, but certainly a similar scenario to such a thing.
You're right. You're right.
The Black Lives Matter cause, the George Floyd protest, this went on in cities all across America. Portland was not isolated in this. This happened all over the country and the world, as a matter of fact. The question I have is what did you learn in your time out there that you maybe didn't know, either from the interviews that you did later or from your time in the streets? What did you learn from all of this?
This is, I'll tell you, I got a good answer for that. What I learned was actually pretty shocking to me. Before going into this, I had a special hatred of police and the local police, especially because of the news stories that I read about these cops getting caught with Nazi propaganda and stuff like that, and then getting promotions afterwards. But and all of it is so crazy that it kind of feels unbelievable. And so I started to question my sources, even though my sources were legit ones as far as other news, and because it was so obnoxiously white supremacist, like out in the open, not just a racial bias issue, you know, like it was literal praising of Hitler kind of stuff was and I can, if you want to know, to give a reference, the guy's name Mark Kruger. He was a police officer that put up Nazi plaques in Rocky Butte Park a couple years prior to George Floyd dying. So that kind of radicalized me. And I expected, honestly, to get there and realize how much I had been maybe manipulated through the sources, because I chose my sources based on my political beliefs. And I was hoping for the reality of it to be a little tamer. And in fact, the reality of it was far worse. In fact, that Mark Kruger guy, who outed himself as a Nazi proudly, ended up being the most paid overtime collector officer of the whole protest for the whole summer. He was the front and center, the lead of the whole thing. And so to me, that is just, I tell people that a lot of people either are already on my side or they don't believe me, even though the sources are all there. It's all out in the open. It's not hidden. It just feels like an unbelievable situation that these guys are literal white supremacists in the police force and get promoted for showing that.
The FBI did a report in, I want to say 1998, that this was something to be on the lookout for, that these kinds of groups were infiltrating the military and the police around the United States. So it's not new.
Well, infiltrate. They created. Portland was founded by white supremacists, and then we slowly became more liberal till we were extremely liberal. But the police force never got overhauled. It never got rooted out. In fact, they just got sick of living here. So now 80% of the cops, you'll see this in the doc, 80% of the cops in Portland don't live here. So it's not their community to protect. And they just keep hiring their cousins and their brothers or whatever. That's my guess. I don't know that for a fact, but I'm guessing somehow they've maintained their status of white supremacy since their inception, which wasn't that long ago. You know, less than 100 years ago, Black people weren't allowed to buy property in Oregon. That was the only state in the union that was like that at the time. So we're right now, you know, and the doc highlights this, is that we need to reckon with our past in Oregon, with that we were the haven for racists who were too racist for the South. They moved out here once they couldn't have slaves anymore, you know, and they built Oregon, not Seattle and San Francisco and the other West Coast towns. I'm sure they had their own issues, but Oregon was specifically the racist haven, the white supremacist haven. And we just point to me in history when the police got overhauled from that situation. It never happened. And that's what, and so we're stuck with it.
It is a disheartening situation, and I hope something comes from this, and something changes soon. What are your plans for the documentary? I mean, are you going to do festivals? Is it going to be out where people might see it?
So we did have a pre-screening already, and 20,000 people watched it for 2 days because we advertised it in the Willamette Weekly. Actually, we didn't advertise. The Willamette Weekly came to us. They got caught wind of it because of the trailer. It was real nice to have them come to me because I've been trying to get them to play my music videos and whatever for years, and they never respond. And so when they emailed me saying, hey, can we write up on this, it was awesome. But the actual release, I can't really comment on that. I am the director and the editor and the cameraman, but I got a couple others on my team that are handling that end of it, and I'm just not, I intentionally try to stay out of it because it stresses me out, and I feel powerless in that realm because it's just not my thing, you know, getting distribution and all that. So I have a producer that's on it.
That's great to know. I hope we can see that on Netflix maybe someday.
We it's not like we just don't know what to do. We have some interested parties, and I can't comment on it right now because no one's given any commitment yet.
Of course, you can't release that kind of information at this point, but you are trying is my point. You're trying to get it out there where a larger audience could see this.
Yeah, it's looking bright right now.
I want to play another clip. This is another 30 seconds that I really stands out in my mind as an important part of what your movie is saying here. Let's play that.
Okay.
The real things that a revolution needs that are important, or an uprising, whatever you want to call it, is it needs space and it needs resources. It needs food and buildings and time and a little money. But it also needs philosophers and artists. It needs people that can imagine a new world and that can find rational, very easy, not easy to explain, but explainable, tangible solutions that can be used in everyday life.
This story has such a impact upon this country right now. This is kind of as the movie is called, Tipping Point. It really feels like this 100-plus days in Portland was a tipping point. I think it was an appropriate title for your film. And I want to commend you for doing it, for taking the shot that you took. And I hope it gets out where people can see it. Again, where can people see the trailer?
It's unfortunately the easiest way right now is to get on Facebook and go to the Old Church Concert Halls page, and then check under the video tabs or just scroll down and you'll see it.
Okay. What else have you been doing in film production? You do music videos.
Yeah, music videos are kind of my bread and butter for my business. I do about one a month or so, but what I'd really like to plug right now is actually a show called Contrast with a K. Just one second here. Yeah, I'm recording here. My office just got some people coming here. All right, it's an all black and white documentary series where I make like these 10-minute episodes, and that's straight from me. Like, that's no one's hiring me to do that. I just realized that in my line of work, I'm surrounded by some incredibly talented people that don't necessarily get the kind of coverage that they deserve. It's like a really moody half music video, half informative, kind of almost spiritual themed take on musicians and why they write their music. And you can get that, you can find that at contrastdocs.com, contrast with a K.
That sounds very interesting. I'll be sure to look that up. Thank you so much. The movie is called Tipping Point. The trailer is out there. If you look up Facebook, The Old Church. And John Meyer, director, filmmaker, and protest warrior out there on the streets in Portland, taking one for the team. I really do appreciate your time, John. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
We'll be looking forward to seeing this documentary wherever it may be when it does get out there. I hope you let me know so I can plug this and get this out to the folks.
Yeah, I will.
Thank you again.
Hi.
Past episodes of Times Like Now can be found wherever you get your programs. Special thank you to the letter J, Cody Robertson, For original music, my name is Trevor Collins. I can be reached, Trevor, at timeslikenow.com.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Andy, moan, my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Fanny Curtat. She is the art historian behind the show Beyond Van Gogh, The Immersive Experience, which opens at the Oregon Convention Center on November the 19th. And it's a show of projected paintings by Van Gogh and animations. Fanny, talk to me by Zoom from Montreal. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Fanny.
If you want to start from the experience, the whole goal is to take the audience through this journey. And so not have from the get-go only setting foot in what we call the immersive room. It's really about going through different stages. You have three rooms. The first one that we call the introduction hall, which is really about getting to know Van Gogh. So it's about providing texts and quotes from Vincent to get the audience to know more, especially with somebody as notorious as Van Gogh, as famous as him. There's sort of this double edge to this level of notoriety where people tend to only remember mostly the negative aspect of his life, almost his legend, this myth of the suffering, troubling, tortured artist, the struggling Matisse, the poverty, the ear-cutting incident. And all of this is true, but only to a certain extent. And also, it tends to get in the way of the appreciation of the sheer power of the work itself, because all of this darkness, that's not what you see when you look at Van Gogh's work. You see